This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.
Well, hello, everybody. It is Readers Entertainment Radio, and this is Patricia W. Fisher, and it is March 5th. And this is just a personal note. Today would have been my grandfather's 100th and first birthday. He was a first-generation American, and he was very proud of that. And so he was just a really cool presence in my life. And so this day always gives me a lot of smiles because he was a pretty decent, cool guy. And then also, what do we have here on the official observances here in the U.S.? Well, we have all sorts of stuff. We have, it's National Craft Month, and it's National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. So if you're not sure what that's all about, you can check on the CDC website. You can check several different websites regarding colon health. I know that it's not a fun test to do, but it's super important, and colon cancer, if it's caught early, is extremely treatable. And I've had actually friends of mine, sadly, who have passed from colon cancer who are very young, and have others that have been family members who have been diagnosed in their 70s and 80s and were treated, and they're still around. It's been 15, 20 years. So please, you know, do your due diligence. I promise you the worst part of that procedure is the prep. And once the prep is done, it is like the best nap you'll ever have, and you're finished, anywhere from 5 to 10 years. So in regard to needing another test. So please be aware of that. It's also Girl Scout Week next week. So if you are absolutely interested at all in Girl Scout cookies or supporting the Girl Scouts, you can do that through cookie sales, or simply just go on girlscouts.org, and they will give you all sorts of information. But in the meantime, we have a fabulous author here today. Her name is Rose Amberley, and she spends her morning arguing with stubborn women, counts bells as Big Ben strikes the hour, and undresses army officers as she sails the boat up the River Thames. She's been a mermaid, a teacher, a musician, and an orange tree, and she's dueled with Vikings and made love in the rain, and all before lunch. Why? Because she's a writer and creator of worlds. And her first books of her English Channel series are out now, with book 3 on the way for April. And you can find Rose at her website, Instagram, Facebook, and Goodreads. All the links are in the write-up of the show. Welcome. How are you today, Miss Rose?
Hi. Just call me Rosie. Hi.
Rosie, how are you today, my dear?
I'm well, thank you. I just wanted to say I'm calling from England, and if the line dies in the middle, I'll call you right back. This is the challenge of cross-Atlantic communication.
Yes. Well, you know, I was mentioning before we were on, and then, like you said, it cut out. Today would have been my grandfather's 101st birthday, and he was first-generation American. Yeah, he was first-generation American. His family came over right after World War I, and his parents. And I can't imagine, you know, we'd read some of the letters that they'd write back and forth back home to Denmark. And I can't imagine the amount of time, you know, it took to get letters here and there. You know,
yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, we'll be okay with the.
To my grandparents.
Yeah, yeah, it will
yeah,
be okay
well, people,
with a bit of cutting out
the
and
country.
Such. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. I mean, it's funny, really. You say this, we take communication for granted these days, and long ago in our grandparents' time, when you left the country, you didn't see or hear from people for years.
Yeah, I mean it's. It's very sobering. It's interesting. It's not been that long ago. I mean, my great-grandfather immigrated, my great-grandmother, in 1918. I mean, that's 100 years, 102 years, 3 years.
Yeah.
Not that long ago. Yeah. So I don't think people realize people were still immigrating through Ellis Island and everything into, I believe, the 1930s.
Yes, so. I suppose so, yes, because I still hear about people waiting to catch the boats in Liverpool to go to America.
Yeah. Oh, it just, wow. It's really, you know, there's still people who may have, you know, who have emigrated like that. I mean, it's amazing. So, it's, I think we get so wrapped up in technology that the idea is, well, that's always been there. It's not been that long ago that, and you know, coming by boat and all that stuff was, you know, hundreds of years, and it's not been that at all.
Yeah.
Well, and for America, because we're a relatively young country, but for your country, I mean, it's relative, right? Because, you know, we're saying, oh, it's 100 years ago, and you're like, amateurs. You know what I mean?
That's nothing. That's like yesterday. We're a very old country, I know. A troglodyte.
Yes. Well, I like troglodytes. They're lovely. So how long have you been writing?
It's a funny thing, really. I've been making up stories since I was maybe 7 or 8. I remember being taken to see a movie when I was really young. We were, briefly because of my dad's job, we were in Africa. We'd be at the time Somalia. I mean, they've kind of split up since then, but the country, not my parents, but... and we went to see this film, which was an Indian film, and I didn't understand the thing. And the next day, I was in the garden making up this dramatic scene, and my mum was watching me from the bathroom. She said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, the hero is going to die."
Oh, no.
So, in a way, I've always loved making up stories, and I used to be a little, you know, got a little bit older and I was in my early teens, I'd be a little bit embarrassed about people finding out because I thought, you know, I'm a little bit weird. I keep talking to myself. fortunately now, I get to talk to myself all the time and seems people like it.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's funny because now, you know, I'll do that in my car. I will drive and I'll be talking out a scene, like dialogue. And now that we have, you know, hands-free and you can, I always make sure that someone can see my phone, like I'm talking on the phone, but really I'm just talking to myself as if anybody would care as we're driving, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, really. I mean, I think some people are born with a love of stories, and I'm sure you as a writer would have had that experience when you were little, that you couldn't get enough books to read.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was driving my mom crazy. Like, can I have more stories? And she'd say, look, I just bought you 5 books last week. What did you do, eat them?
Yeah.
Because to me, stories were absolutely a crucial part of my, just the way my mind functioned.
Right.
But then I kind of didn't become a proper writer for years and years afterwards. I'd write little things and then be too embarrassed to tell anyone about them, so I would hide them and, you know, in the back of my desk or on the back of my laptop, and no one would know about them until I think about 20 years ago. I had a friend who was an actor, and they said they were looking for playwrights who wrote stories about women. And so I got into theatre first. And I was a playwright for quite a while, about 15 years. And I think it was about 6 years ago when I decided to make the move into fiction. So quite a journey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how were you self-taught in regard to writing plays? Because that's a whole different format from even screenwriting versus short stories. I mean, did you teach yourself? Had you had proper training? How did you do that?
It's a funny thing. No, I initially haven't had any training at all. You know, sometimes I think I've seen a lot of plays and I've read a lot of plays. I'm one of those people, there are not many, who can actually read a play script. and make sense out of it, because it's just pure dialogue. There's no description at all. So I think the first couple of things I wrote weren't based on any kind of training. Eventually, I actually did a directing course because I wanted to understand how the medium worked that I was writing for.
Right.
And then you learn from experience. I mean, when you work with actors and directors, they will tell you what's expected. They'll say things like, you don't need to really say this because the actor will just show it.
Sure.
So you learn to write very sparsely, literally a minimum of words. I remember one guy telling me, think that every word you put on the page is going to cost you £5. So don't put it down unless it's essential.
Wow.
And of course, when you come to fiction, it's a very different thing because you have to give a description. You have to explain how, when people are talking, their facial features, their tone of voice, he asked, he said, he demanded, all of that stuff. And when I made the move, I wasn't used to this. So
right.
People will tell me, we don't know where your characters are. They could be in outer space. Is it obvious? No, it's not obvious.
Right.
So it was quite a challenge.
Well, I would think, too, that reading those scripts would help a lot because it's just like anybody wanting to study. You're studying the work.
Mm. Yes, you get a feel. I mean, I think almost all readers who read a lot will
mm-hmm.
have an innate sense of what works and what doesn't work. They may not have the desire to create it themselves, but they can tell when something is not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And they might not have the terminology for why there's something wrong with this, but they'll have a sense that you're not connecting to the work properly. And I think that's how all works of art really work. You don't have to be an expert. I actually don't buy into this, you know, everybody needs to have degrees and PhDs before they can comment on whether it's a film or a novel or a poem or a, you know, an orchestra.
Right.
I think when something is good, it touches you. And if it doesn't touch you, then either it's not meant for you or it's rubbish.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, people like
Sorry,
Steven Spielberg didn't finish.
Sorry, I'm being rude here. I'm not being diplomatic, but there you go.
No, not at all. Because, I mean, Steven Spielberg, for one, he didn't finish his degree. He went back and finished because, like, I don't know, like 10 years ago. And the joke was, well, maybe you'll do something with your life, was the joke. But it's one of those things where the practical is just as important as the actual books. And
yeah.
I was and went to nursing school, and it was a year-long program for what's called an licensed vocational nurse or licensed practical nurse, LVN, LPN. And my goal was to eventually, you know, stair-step into being an RN and possibly nurse practitioner at some point. But this got me in the door, and I remember those first 6 months studying, and then I became a nurse's aide about 6 months in, and I learned just as much or more practical as with the books.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I think that back and forth, that good blend of, you know, getting the basics and then being able to use the basics are essential.
You must have seen a lot of stories as part of your nursing work, because that's life at the sharp end, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I actually, you know, include some of it. And it's funny because people, you know, they joke about different stuff and, oh, that would never happen. But, I mean, honestly, truth is stranger than fiction, which I'm sure you found as well in playwriting and acting and, I mean, in the whole theater world, it's truth is stranger than fiction.
Yes. You often hear things like, you know, you couldn't make this up.
Right.
And I've worked as an addiction counselor and not quite a therapist, but kind of a mentor. And some of the stories you hear, I would not be able to put in a book because no one would believe them.
Right.
you know, there's this one girl who told me about how she sold her house and she borrowed money and everything to try and help her boyfriend, you know, do this project of his. And, you know, he was cheating on her and not even calling her back. And you think no one would do that. But the truth is actually people behave in ways that are really complex. And when you're dealing with people who have suffered, it makes you realize that there's so much we don't know. And yes, not films and not novels and not anything would even touch the size.
Right. And it's just, and sometimes I would think too, those kinds of moments in getting into a character's psyche, especially, you know, no matter the format, is definitely a challenge for any really good author.
Yes, but if you love it, then it's great.
Yes. Oh, for sure. For sure. So tell me about, you've got your English Channel series. So tell me, you've been playwriting, you've been doing all this. Now, what was the catalyst to make you say, okay, now I'm going to write this series?
I'll tell you, but you must promise not to laugh.
I will not laugh.
I was actually in the, I was in the middle of writing this play I'd been commissioned to do, and it was about Middle Eastern politics, of all things. This was about 6 years ago. 2015, and it was, you know, there was the whole war in Syria stuff, and I was having to do research. And you know when you get on the internet and you're doing research and you get down a rabbit hole and you come out somewhere totally different. And I came on this description of an island in the English Channel, which I'd never heard of. It's a tiny, tiny island, and they said basically, in this island, they don't allow cars at all. They don't even allow street lights at night because they have this thing where they don't want any light pollution so you can see the stars. And they have a certificate from some international dark sky body that says that they have absolutely no light pollution. And the entire island basically is pedestrian, and it's owned and governed by this one, it's like a feudal lord, really. And it was such a surprising thing. So I looked it up, and it was so beautiful. The pictures of it were so pretty. And I remember thinking, I would love to write something that's based there. You know, never mind the Middle East. I want to do this one. And you realize that actually, because it's so visual, this is not something that will lend itself to theater. It needs more description. And I had this idea in my head always, for years and years, about a woman whose horrible husband tells her she's ugly, and tells her it's her fault that he's cheating. And then on the same day, she reads a newspaper vacancy advert for a job, and it says applicants must not be attractive. And she thinks, well, since I'm ugly, I'll apply. And it was just this, like, kernel of idea. And I put the two together, and I thought, what if she applied for a job and she got to go to this really gorgeous island? And it totally, the whole idea just took hold of me, and it wouldn't let go for about 6-7 months. It was bouncing around in my head. And eventually I sat down, and I began to write it. And literally, you know, you've heard this expression before, you know, things changed and the rest is history. That's exactly how it was. It was like I opened the door, walked through, and I was in a different place. And I never looked back.
Wow. What island is this called again? The actual island?
Well, the real place, yeah, it's called Sark. I actually changed the name a little bit because you know, women fiction, you know, you're talking about a real place and you're talking about the guy who runs the place, and so you don't want to then be sued. So
right,
so I called it Lacanet.
Okay.
I think I remember seeing
pictures or something of it several years ago. But there was actually a show in the United States, gosh, what was it? I want to say, 10 years ago, and it was called Ugly Betty. And it was actually based on a telenovela. It wasn't based, but, I mean, it had a telenovela qualities to it and such, and it was delightful and fun. But it was about a magazine mongol. He had all this stuff, and his son he put in basically charge of one of the magazines just to kind of keep him out of trouble. And the guy just couldn't basically keep it in his pants. And so what happened was is the dad hires an ugly assistant. So the son will actually get work done. And it's this whole process of, like you're saying, the self-discovery and realizing you're far more than you think you are. And it was a cool journey. So I'm loving the whole, discovering your strengths and your beauty line. That's always a cool story.
Yeah. I think this is why I've chosen to write in the particular niche that I write in, which, romance is a really wide genre. And what I particularly like writing about is women discovering themselves. Yes, we want her to get the guy, but we want her to get it right for herself first, because I think
right.
If you're not strong enough, if you don't respect yourself, you can't ask other people to respect you. If you don't love yourself enough, you can't expect anyone else to love you. Other people don't replace how you should treat yourself. And so for me, all of my stories are about women who actually, it's their journey, and it's making a wonderful life for themselves and growing through the journey of the story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that we all want to be, when we're reading, we want to relate. We've all felt bad about ourselves. We've all had, bad days. But, yeah, we want to see that person be able to say, you know what, I'm a lot stronger than I thought I was. I mean, and I love those
stories.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we, particularly as women, we've not been encouraged to think of ourselves as strong. we've been a lot of time, a lot less now, thank God. When you look back at what used to be published, 30, 40 years ago, it was all about her being helpless and the guy would be, masterful and a little bit rude and he would rescue her and fix her.
Mm-hmm.
And now, thank God, things have changed a little bit. And we are beginning to understand, actually, we are, in fact, the stronger sex, we are the more resilient. We're more able to survive. But what we still don't have enough of is confidence. We are so easily undermined, just someone has to tell us. I mean, this is like my first story where, the guy says to her, you're fat and ugly. And that's it. She believes it for quite a while. It totally takes the wind out of her.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how many times I've heard people, women say that to me. I can't do this, or I don't look right doing that, or people will think me a bitch, or people will think me, not very nice. So I think it's important to celebrate a woman's journey of discovery. And I think also a woman's ability to laugh at the world and laugh at herself and not take
mm-hmm.
things too seriously. I like a touch of romantic comedy, don't you?
Oh, very much. It's hopeful. I know that a lot of people kind of, I've heard a lot of different comments about people joking about Hallmark movies and such. And yes, we're watching it because we know we want the happily ever after, and we know we want, light conflict, because the world can be heavy. But there's nothing wrong with wanting hope. It's just, why wouldn't you?
Nothing.
Why wouldn't you?
Nothing
want
at all.
It?
And there's enough misery when you turn on the radio. We're not pretending.
Yeah.
Look, there are so many men who will read science fiction And of course they don't believe that aliens are going to invade the Earth and they're going to have to defend it from attacking the White House. We know that that's, you know, fiction. It's a bit of escapism, and there's nothing wrong with creating something beautiful. I think romance gets a really bad reputation, doesn't get enough respect.
Right.
And it's not fair, because it's actually, having been writing for a long time, I tell you, it's one of the hardest things to write. Because if you write any other kind of fiction, you have an open-ended ending. You don't know, you know, you can go anyway. With a romance, you can't. You know, you know, there's no mystery there. The girl's going to get the guy at the end, and they're going to live happily ever after. So in order to keep someone turning pages, when they know in advance how it's going to end, that takes quite a bit of skill to keep them
right.
engaged, to keep their heart in the reading. Otherwise, why would they read?
Right, and it has to
so
make sense. I mean, right, and it has to make sense. It can't be, well, we'll just throw them together because that's the easiest thing to do. I mean, we have to know why these two people would want to be together and why, you know, these things happen in their lives and what makes sense. And, I mean, yeah, it's definitely the human psyche is difficult. And it doesn't matter whether it's on a Harlequin-level
yeah.
sweet romance or it's hot and heavy. It's got to make sense.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, human attraction is complicated, and there are different reasons for why. You know, my mum used to say, every cracked cup has its saucer, and it just means, you know, you can't say everyone has to be like that for them to be able to
right.
fall in love. Actually, what attracts people to other people is such an individual thing.
There is a movie. Have you seen the movie Coco?
No, I haven't. I've heard of it. I've heard it mentioned.
Yes.
And it's on my list now.
There is a beautiful, so it's based, it's called Coco because the great-grandmother's name is Coco. And it talks about the Day of the Dead, and Mexico has these beautiful ceremonies where, you know, those that have gone before us can come back over, and we can, you know, we put the ofrendas out, and we have food, and it's a celebration. And so it talks about this gentleman who can't cross over because there's no picture on the ofrenda, and he keeps wanting to come back because his daughter now, who's the great-grandmother, she's forgetting him. And if you're forgotten completely, you go to the final death. And so the grandson gets all mixed up in everything. But there's this song that the great-grandfather sings, and it's talking about everyone knows Juanita, and it's saying her eyes are a different color and her chin sticks out and her legs, it's like talking about her legs are bowed and she's got this raggedy hair and everything, and you're thinking, oh, this is, you know, not a nice song. And then at the very last line, it's, and if I weren't so ugly, you'd possibly give me a chance. And you're like, so he's singing a love song, you know, everyone's thinking, oh, he's making fun, and he's actually singing about someone he's enamored with. And so, like you're saying, we don't know what attracts to whom, you know? And that's kind of
yeah.
the beauty of writing those romances, is definitely finding what attracts these two people together.
Yes, and it is, it's a lovely journey of discovery. I mean, you were asking me what made me write what I do. And as I said, you know, I wake up in the morning excited. The first time I've woken up every morning excited about working, because you can go on that journey with them and you can live in that world that you're creating.
Yes.
I think we were saying this some time ago. In my second story, it's based on this fashion designer who designs wedding dresses, and having to do the research and look into the different kinds of fabric and how their designs and the different ideas. It was the most fun, I tell you. I have never had so much fun researching a book as I did earlier this year, because it is just, last year I should say now, it was in the middle of the pandemic. We weren't doing anything. We were locked in the house. I don't know if
right.
you had the same in Texas where you are, but in London we were on lockdown, so we weren't allowed out of the house except once to go for a walk for 20
yes.
minutes, and then we had to come back.
Well, we weren't that severe lockdown. Our political officials tended to downplay it and have actually just recently taken the mask mandate away when our numbers are still high. So needless to say, people are freaking out and angry. But no, we did not have it that way just because our representatives don't want to talk about it. So it's fun. So a lot of us are staying home for the sake of health and sanity.
It's really difficult because, I know. And it's easier for those of us who work from home anyway and who work online and who can invent stories and trouble in our heads.
Sure.
But for all the people I know, it was very difficult. And people who live in small flats, with, you know, no balcony and two toddlers, oh my God, I'm sure it was hell for them.
Yeah.
But as I said, I got to go online and research wedding dresses from across the world. It was so much fun. And then I got to create this dress and think of how I could make it really pretty.
Right.
And how I'd make it relevant. Because I think I've always had this idea, that a wedding dress has got to be a really personal thing. It's like dating. You can't go and buy something off the shelf. It has to match the personality of the bride and the personality of the life they want to have together.
Right.
And so it was so much fun having to kind of think of what my character, who's a designer, trying to learn enough about the woman she's making a dress for, who says, I don't want to wear couture. I don't want, you know, we've got money, we can buy the most expensive dress in the world, and I don't want to because that's not me. I don't want to walk down the aisle looking like every other bride.
Right.
And so then she comes up with this idea where she can make something that feels like her. You know, I think if you can do that for a job, if you can invent things like that in your head, I think it's one of the best jobs in the world.
Oh, for sure. I mean, what were some of the things that surprised you about wedding dresses when you were looking at materials or designs? Or, I mean, was there certain themes that you saw in different countries or different cultures that was just, this absolutely has to happen versus this is something unique? What did you see?
Yeah, for example, in India, the wedding sari is normally red, particularly in certain parts of the country. It's not
right.
white. The whole white dress is a Western thing. In fact, in some cultures, white is a funeral color. And I think once you break out of this box of it has to be white, it has to have a veil, you start to discover, like in Africa, again, it's like a lot of fabric, like the woman is wrapped in a lot of fabric and it's very bright colors.
Yes.
And then the jewelry that goes with it. But also even in Western designs, you realize things, for example, about how a dress is made, that before you make the dress, you make a dummy dress out of like a cheap fabric because you can't tell how it will hang on the bride's body until she actually wears it. You know,
right.
you can draw as many pictures as you like. Until she wears it and moves around in it, you can't tell whether, you know, the cut can be just slightly different and it will make her bottom look bigger or smaller or makes her feel like she's swaying as she walks or she's being stiff and uncomfortable. One of the things that I actually quite liked and I ended up using it is that you can hand paint You can create a dress in different layers, and then you can hand paint little things on the different layers. So then when the bride walks and the layers, kind of the cloth shifts and moves, it looks like she's walking in a field and these flowers are kind of flying around her feet.
Wow.
And it was interesting to discover how you can create that effect.
Huh. I watched
Crazy Rich Asians, like a lot of people, and I remember there's the scene in the wedding where the water comes up, you know, and she's walking through what looks like, you know, a marsh, and they have the fireflies, lights and everything. And I'm sitting there the whole time thinking, but her dress is wet, you know, but this is, but then she had a whole nother outfit for the reception, and you had a whole nother outfit for this. And so it's the idea of, but it's just one dress, and it's not. I mean, it depends on the wedding you want, correct?
Oh, yeah. And that's another thing in India. It's actually a seven-day wedding, and so they have several outfits. You know, the main ceremony, and then there's a big dinner reception, and then the next day, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after that. And you think, actually, yeah, that's how it should be, because all this preparation and stress, I mean, here, there's no bride that gets married. I mean, I got married, I think we decided, and we got engaged, and then got married 6 weeks later, and the only slot that was available at the town hall was at 9:15 in the morning, and said, that's it, that's when we're doing it. And in fact, you'll have a wedding breakfast, which really will be breakfast. For most people, they're planning it for a year and a half. And you think all this planning and hard work, and then it's over in a day, and it's so stressful that actually you don't feel it and you don't enjoy it because you're worried about all the details. No, let's have it for a whole week so you could really feel it.
Right. And then that gives opportunity, my understanding. I have friends from Mexico and I have friends, you know, from all over the world, and they've talked about it. So a friend of mine in Mexico, they had like a rehearsal dinner, and then you have the rehearsal dinner, then you have the reception, then you have the breakfast. To me, it's just like, you know, layer and layers, because all these people have come from all these different places to celebrate with you. So you know, have this very long celebration because people spend their time coming. And you have opportunities for different people in your family to, you know, I will take care of this breakfast and I will take care of this part of the reception. And it's just, it's like this huge effort, you know, within your own, your family, your community, that you're doing this.
And I think what you say is absolutely right. It's family and community. I think when you have a lot of community working with you, you're not on your own having to do everything yourself. And I think we have, and particularly now because of COVID, we have really become very insular. And there's something really beautiful about living within a community that all, you know, pitch in together. And that was one of the nice things about being able to set my stories where I did, because when you have an old-fashioned island where things have to be slow because you don't have fast cars or trains or buses or anything like that, then everything has to be much more gentle and much more relaxed. And people, you know, pitch in together. And, you know, when this young woman goes into labor unexpectedly and has a child and nobody even knew she was pregnant, and the next day, you know, because she can't get off the island to go shopping and buy things for the baby, everybody sends her baskets of, you know, their own old baby clothes and toys and things like that. And I love this feeling of, you know, a whole community coming in together and doing things for each other. And it's I think, you know, we were talking earlier about escapism and writing about places that are fun to imagine. I think we all want to feel a sense of love, not just with the person we fall in love with, but with the entire world we live in, the community we live in. And I think if you can imagine such a place, you start to think, I want to go there. And actually, one of my one of my readers wrote me an email. She said, please tell me this is a real place. I'd like to go and visit it. And I thought, yes, me too, me too.
You know, when you were talking about people being generous and helping in a community, I don't know if you've seen the play Come From Away or heard about it.
No.
So I ended up getting, my family and I ended up getting tickets through some friends that couldn't go last minute. And it's it was a Broadway play. It won tons of awards. It was on in the West End. And it's about this island let me make sure I say it. It's Gander in Newfoundland. And it was 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
And all the planes were grounded. And so Gander used to be a huge hub when people could only fly for so long from, Europe and then obviously the other way. And so they just started grounding all these flights that were heading into the United States. And this airport, who usually now only had like 10 flights a day, had 37 planes grounded. And the people were on the flights, sitting on the planes for almost 24 hours. They weren't telling them anything. The town has 10,000 people. And basically they opened up their homes, their stores, their schools, their everything. They made cots and they fed them and never asked for a dime. And it's all these different, it's about 20 people that play all of these characters in town. They just change, like they put a vest on or they take a vest off, put a jacket. And it's this beautiful, seamless change on stage. And it talks about just taking care of each other in this crisis.
Yes.
They're actually going to make, like Hamilton did for Disney, they recorded everything with the original cast before everybody started going different directions. Well, they're going to come back and do one of those for Come From Away. So people who can't necessarily get to the play or the theater at some point or ever, they can see it on TV. But it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And then they had people from all over, the people coming in from Africa, flights in Germany and Paris and everywhere. And when they left, everybody left after like a week or so, they went to the town hall and there was a comments box. And people had gone in and shoved money in these boxes so people could replenish their store stock. And their, And they were just going into the stores and getting baby, diapers and clothes and feminine products. And I mean, just everything, and never charged a dime. So it was just like you're talking about, that community feeling. People can do it.
Yes, and I think I wish they would do that on the news. I wish there would be a segment on the news. After all the war and the politicians arguing and everything, where they would tell us stories like this, because actually people can be amazingly generous and amazingly giving. If only, we have a little bit of faith in the human spirit.
Yeah. I wish, there was more of those stories, and it would be, I think people might just have a better mood in general, but maybe that's just the idealist and romantic in me. I don't know. But we do need to see the positive as much as we see the negative, because,
Yeah,
it's never good to see just one or the other, for sure. So,
and that's
well, thank
the
you
way
so,
I like
yes.
what I like now.
Yes. Well, and speaking of wonderful stories, you have two out now, and you've got a third coming out next month. So right now is Plain Jane Wanted, English Channel Book 1, Unwanted Bride, English Channel Book 2, and then Dreamcatcher Wanted is coming out April 21st.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And all characters that you find on this island, so
Lovely. I have been talking, for everyone listening, I've been talking to Rose Amberly. She is a fabulous author that you need to read two of her books before her third book comes out next month, and it is on pre-order, and the link is in the write-up of the show. Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much. It was lovely chatting to you.
Absolutely. Yes, and we will stay in touch, and everybody go and check out Rose's books. You can also check her out on her website, Instagram, Facebook, and Goodreads. All the links are in the write-up of the show, as well as her book links. And everybody, keep on reading and stay safe.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.